If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today, we've got a bonus podcast for you about Henry V. Over the last week, Netflix film The King has been garnering a lot of attention for its portrayal of the medieval king and the 1415 Battle of Agincourt. To find out about the historical accuracy of the film and the history that inspired it, our content director Dave Musgrove spoke to Lauren Johnson, a historian and author specialising in the 15th and early 16th centuries.
We're talking about the new Netflix film, The King, which is a retelling of the Henry V story, following William Shakespeare's plays to an extent. Now, you don't have to have seen the film to enjoy this podcast, I hope, and we're not going to go into too much detail about what's in it. And as a spoiler, I don't think it's too much to say that Henry V wins the Battle of Agincourt in the film. Now, I'm joined by Lauren Johnson, whose recent book, Shadow King, explores the life and death of Henry VI, the king who followed Henry V to the English throne. So obviously a topic that that she will know a lot about. Lauren's watched the film and done an excellent review of it for our website, historyextra.com. And as I said, the film charts the story of Henry V from the young philandering Prince Hal up to the serious war leader and political player, Henry V. So I suppose the first thing for you, Lauren, is what did you take from the film in terms of its historical accuracy? I don't want to go into all the things, you know, there are lots of things that I'm sure we could go into that were incorrect, but in general, what did it get right from the historical record as we know it?
Well, interesting, one of the things that is correct is that story of the kind of wastrel Hal turning into the responsible King Henry V, because there's, although the earliest source, the Gesta Henrici Quinti, doesn't refer to this, there are sources within Henry's lifetime and then by people who know him, who refer to the fact that he undergoes quite a change when he becomes king. He goes from being someone who, I think one chronicler puts it, that he is a lover of Venus and of Mars in his youth, meaning essentially he got up to all sorts of hijinks as a young person. And then when he was crowned king in 1413, he changed and became more grave, more serious-minded about the business of government. And of course, there's a lot in the film as well about his military prowess, which certainly is true. He was an extremely effective, if very ruthless, commander.
So the transformation story from young man to proper serious king, there is an element of accuracy in that. So Shakespeare wasn't making that up?
Not entirely. Obviously, being Shakespeare, he takes it the next step further. So he has Hal not, and I'm going to refer to him as Hal in the film just to make life slightly simpler. If I'm talking about Henry V, it's the real Henry V.
Okay.
Hal in the film and in Shakespeare's adaptation of Henry V as well is hanging out with very low-born people. You know, he's hanging out in Mistress Quickly's inn with John Falstaff and various other lowly individuals getting drunk all the time. And that's probably overstating it a bit. I mean, Henry V was still ultimately a prince. He was still going to hang out with his own milieu, I'd say, more than is represented in the film.
Okay. And why then, if there is truth in that story of him, of there being a transformation, why would it have occurred, do you think? Would he have felt that suddenly the weight of power meant that he had to take on a bigger responsibility?
I suspect that. Probably it's been slightly overstated, as I say. But I do think there is something transformative in that coronation ritual, in the movement from being a prince who is one of four princes, in fact, which is something the film doesn't really acknowledge, the fact he had several brothers, to becoming a king who is completely alone, who has full responsibility for the kingdom and for every single person who is within it. That's a very different thing, I think. But what is interesting in the film is they have Timothée Chalamet playing Hal, and he is a fairly young actor. I think he's in his early 20s. which reflects the fact that actually lots of these soldiers were effectively child soldiers. The nobility of England in this time were fighting from their teens or early 20s at the eldest. And I think that's quite nice that they play up that aspect of him, that this is someone who is fighting from youth, who is very well schooled in military matters.
You mentioned his brothers there. I mean, part one of the film's lines is that he's kind of forced into being the king that he becomes because one of his brothers wants to fight in a battle that he's kind of, you know, he doesn't want his brothers to have to do. Anything in that?
No, I mean, that's nonsense.
Absolutely.
Absolute nonsense. They also have, and I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler, but they have that brother being killed sort of off screen somewhere in Wales, which is completely made up. It's Thomas, Duke of Clarence, who goes on to fight for Henry for many years, in fact, right through till 1421. He does die in battle, but it's the Battle of Bourget against the French and Scottish forces. So it's a very different situation from him dying sort of on Henry IV's watch fighting a pointless Welsh war.
But no particular fraternal pressure for Henry to step up from any of these brothers?
No, I think these brothers were very... There was tension between Henry and Clarence, and it does seem Clarence was Henry IV's favourite. He was the second son after Henry V. But no, I don't think so. They seem to have supported him, and it's one of the great advantages that Henry V has, actually, particularly in comparison with his son Henry VI, is that Henry V has three other brothers who can fight for him in France, they can fight for him in England if need be, they can take up government of England when necessary. So were anything to happen to Henry V, and bearing in mind he's wounded in the face in his first battle at the age of 16, if anything happens to him, then the Lancastrian dynasty is absolutely fine because there's these other brothers who are experienced who can take things up for him.
Okay. So just talking a bit more about Henry V, one of the most interesting angles, plot lines in the film is this sense that the young Hal is a pacifist. In some way, doesn't really want to get involved in these martial activities. Just tell me about that.
Well, that's the bit of the film that's most egregious to my mind. That is a departure from Shakespeare, because although Shakespeare makes a point of having Henry V justify his war in France, he still casts him as a soldier, I'd say. Someone who gives, you know, stirring speeches before taking Harfleur, before Agincourt. Whereas, as you say, in this film, the Hal character doesn't want to go to war. There's completely fabricated stories of like an assassination attempt against Henry and other things which may not entirely turn out to be quite what they first appear. One interesting element that they do include in the film that bizarrely does have historical truth is the fact that the Dauphin of France sent Henry V tennis balls to mock him and sort of goad him into fighting. That is true. The Dauphin of France really did, or perhaps his father, Charles VI, send tennis balls and also a reference to soft cushions. They said, here you go, why don't you lounge on your soft cushions and play tennis balls because you're this young gadabout prince, you're not a real king. But the notion that Henry V wouldn't want to go to war is absolutely absurd. He had to justify going to war, definitely. He had to seem to not want to, but he definitively did. He was a soldier before anything else. And that, again, is like a huge difference with his son, who is undoubtedly a pacifist, whose rhetoric is consistently about making peace with France. Henry V wants to fight to force peace as opposed to negotiating for it.
So the tennis ball element, that is attested, that is...
Yes.
There's historical veracity. That's very interesting, isn't it? So that does suggest that this sense that Hal was seen as someone who wasn't a serious player, then if that was going to be something that would
absolutely affect him. And interestingly, Henry V also challenged the Dauphin to single combat, which is something that happens in the film. Again, probably not really expecting it to be taken up, really just using it as yet another way of saying, look, I've tried everything I could, but now I've got to get loads of soldiers killed. So that's quite a standard thing for a medieval prince to do before a battle.
You've mentioned the Dauphin a couple of times there. Perhaps we ought to just say a little bit about, I mean, it's a slightly odd term to English language speakers. Mm. The Dauphin, what does it mean? Who is the Dauphin?
The Dauphin of France is effectively the equivalent of the Prince of Wales. He's the heir to the throne, effectively. And in 1415, at the time of the Battle of Agincourt, that was a man called Louis, the eldest surviving son of Charles VI. Interestingly, whereas Timothée Chalamet is the sort of young King Henry, Robert Pattinson, who plays the Dauphin, is actually quite a bit older. The Dauphin of France was really just a teenager at this time, and he was sickly and stayed with his father away from the battlefield. He got nowhere near Agincourt. But in order to create a narrative of a very sort of simple, ooh, look at this great big baddie over here, the king has created this peculiar Dauphin hybrid who looks a bit like an elf from Lord of the Rings, gone slightly wrong, who talks in the most horrendous French accent and insists on doing this, even though Timothée Chalamet is fluent in French and therefore they could communicate in French. He's like, no, please talk English. It's ugly and simple. I think that actually was better than Robert Pattinson's accent. Thank you. And so effectively the Dauphin is set up as this big bad who makes absurd threats against the English and is ultimately, or should I say, I'm going to say it, he's killed in the Battle of Agincourt, which again is completely untrue. He did die in a bit later that year, but not as a result of the battle.
Okay, we'll come back to the French and French attitudes to this film in a moment. Okay, so we've leapt on to the battle there. We've moved on from Prince Hal being this wasteful figure to being the warrior, leading the troops into the battle, or at least being there on the battlefield. It's a very graphic and quite effective bit of filmography, I think, and it's kind of based around this idea that it was really, really muddy and there's lots of knights in really heavy armour struggling to move around a small patch of field. In the period of your book, Henry VI's life, there were lots of really serious, gory battles. How did you feel this battle scene sort of weighed up to the reality of what might have been a 15th century battle?
I think in some ways, the Battle of Agincourt and the King doesn't quite go far enough. There's descriptions of Agincourt from contemporaries who say that the knights there, the men-at-arms, I should say, because when we imagine knights, we think of people on horseback, and actually the English were all on foot and the French also. Many of them were on fighting on foot too. There's descriptions of them being in the mud up to their knees and sort of falling, you know, face down in it, and great piles of dead assembling in front of the English lines. And there was an element of that in the battle. There was definitely a sense of claustrophobia and there was a sense of muck. But I think it could have even gone further than it was. This was a completely horrific battle in which the French plan of attack was to like punch through the English lines basically with cavalry. And the English, who were outnumbered about 2-3, not quite the many tens of thousands, I think, that it is in Shakespeare. The English plan was basically to bombard them with arrows in order to sort of try and reduce the French lines, which ultimately worked. 15th century battles were, I mean, they were brutal, really. They were battles in which people were hacking and hitting people in the face and the limbs. One element, I would say, of Agincourt that definitely was a bit misleading was the complete greyness of everything. There was no real sense of how people moved at that time, which was very dependent on heraldry and banners and trumpets. And those things are kind of associated with the French in the film and not with the English. But we know that Henry V was fighting under 5 banners by himself, never mind all of the other lords who were there who were also fighting under those things. So certainly, I think by the end of Agincourt, that sense of mud and desperation and misery is fairly accurate. But it would have started off looking very different, I think, from the way it does in the film.
I was quite struck by the battle scene and the way that, as you said, you know, how would people have identified their enemy? I assume there must have been a much bigger element of heraldry, or at least some mechanism whereby one could sit, you know, identify who yeah. you were supposed to be fighting against. Because it does, you know, it just boiled down to this horrible melee of people just. People in armour punching each other in the face, which struck me as... I've never worn a suit of plate armour. I would have thought that would be quite a challenging thing to... I mean, you probably haven't worn plate armour either.
Maybe no, I've tried chainmail on. Yeah. That was quite the experience. I don't think just punching people in the head was a big feature of the Battle of Agincourt. I mean, it's like I say, it didn't quite go far enough. This is a battle where people were, you know, the archers, after they'd finished with all of their arrows, they leapt into the fray with their hose around their ankles, wielding mallets, and were sort of just smashing people on the head. and stabbing them with knives. So it was incredibly sort of visceral, I think, actually, the fighting. And it's interesting as well that Hal in this film doesn't wear a crown at any point. In fact, I don't think there's a single crown throughout the entire film, which I presume was an aesthetic choice they made. Whereas we know specifically that Henry V wore this crown in battle, which had fleur-de-lis on it to emphasise the fact that he was rightful king of France, according to his own rhetoric. And that during the battle, one of the fleurons on the crown was actually knocked off because the fighting was so intense around him. And he was sort of beaten to his knees before getting up again. So, yeah, I think it sort of got maybe that tone of desperation right, but certainly, it wasn't really a medieval battle.
And you just mentioned a point which we probably should have discussed a little bit earlier as to why the English were even fighting in France. And as you said, so Henry's basically saying that he is the rightful heir to the French throne.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It's a continuation of the Hundred Years' War. So it's the King of England saying, no, I should be King of France, actually.
Yeah. A little bit of a curveball that's just occurred to me. As we talk about the graphic brutality of these battles, and we think today about the impact of battles and warfare, throughout the 15th century, you know, the Battle of Towton is you know, the bloodiest battle in English history, isn't it? It's very described. Is there any sense of the aftermath of that for people who fought in those battles? Did they, you know, PTSD is obviously a modern term, but is there any sense that people struggle to come to terms with what must have been a horrifying experience?
I'm sure there is, and especially within the religious culture of that time, the fact that so often you find memorials being put up and prayers for the dead in battles being wished for by the people who were involved in them, chantry chapels and things like that. I'm not so familiar with it with Henry V, to be honest, but certainly with Henry VI, I think it's who never willingly fights in a battle, but finds himself in the middle of them on several occasions, as you say, during the Wars of the Roses. I think that had a profound psychological impact on him. And I think part of the reason it has such an impact is because he's actually quite old by the time he gets to his first battle. Henry V, like I say, child soldier. I think they almost are steeled against these brutal experiences. Whereas Henry VI is 33 before he encounters what a battle is. And it's not Agincourt. It's not that sort of glorious fight against a bunch of knights. Instead, it's a street battle through St. Albans in which he watches people who probably aren't properly armoured being massacred in front of him. So I think, yes, there was a profound psychological impact.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
You bow to the king, you don't look him in the eye. There are records of people just being on their knees in the presence of the king for hours at a time.
Okay, now moving on from the warfare aspect of it, which is a big focus of this film. But one of the other interesting subplots lines in the film is the role of women. And there's a couple of women in the film who... I think
that's literally it. There's two women in the film.
There are. But interestingly, as opposed to other films of this period, you know, of this genre, the women are seen as, in some ways, active agents, i.e. they say something and they're not just there to stand next to the man in armour. What role did women play in high politics at the time, if any?
They definitely had a role in high politics, I would say. And we see it time and again throughout the Hundred Years' War, because specifically these women are often the bridges between the English and the French. They're related often to both sides. So right from the early days of the Hundred Years' War, we have Philippa of Hainaut, for instance, the wife of Edward III, appealing for the citizens of Calais to be saved from the King of England's brutal punishment after Calais is taken. Later on, right at the other end of the spectrum, we find Isabella of Burgundy, for instance, in 1435, getting a payout from the French in order to persuade her husband, the Duke of Burgundy, to make peace with the French, who for 20 years has been his enemy. Charles VI's wife, his queen, Isabeau of Bavaria, in the time of Henry V, is effectively the regent of France. She's running things for him because her husband suffers from mental ill health for so much of his reign. So women are hugely important. They do have quite specific roles. They are meant to be peacemakers. They are meant to be intercessors. They are meant to be agents who are negotiating between the different sides. And that's what we find them doing time and time again. And we see it, you know, right down through the ranks. You know, you see noble women negotiating the ransoms of their husbands to return from war, or to make the most of ransoms for prisoners of war they happen to be looking after at the time, as the case may be. So, yeah, they are hugely important. The one thing in the film, which I think you might have found a bit strange, is the Catherine Valois meeting Hal and sort of presenting him with this.
We should say Catherine Valois.
Ah, yeah. Catherine Valois being the daughter of Charles VI, a French princess, who goes on to marry Henry V and thus cement the treaty, basically, between England and France.
Yeah, and she her words to Henry V, they did strike me as a little odd in where she says she wouldn't submit to him and he needs to earn her respect, wording like that.
Unfortunately, presumably? Yeah, unfortunately, I think that is going too far. Much as women have specific political roles in this period, they are roles that are still ultimately subservient to a king. They're superior to everyone else in the country, you know, king, queen, all the other people. But it's very hard to imagine Catherine Valois saying, no, I'm exactly on the same level as you. In part because, you know, at this point in time, she's quite politically disadvantaged. Her country has just been dragged through 5 years of war. In fact, the film very much sort of jumps to the end in terms of when this treaty is made. She's living in a war zone with her father, who is not entirely with it, with her mother, who's desperately trying to hold things together. There's no dowry, really. And we know that Henry V didn't give Catherine Valois much political agency later in their relationship. We find other princely relationships where it is much more equal, I would say, but Henry V and Catherine Valois is not one, perhaps because she's a French princess and the war continues and it's seen as too dangerous to make her, for instance, a regent during their son's reign.
Sure. Yeah, the director does rather charge through that those last years, and I presume because he had to get to the end to get to the finale of the story.
Yes, and also there's all of those inconvenient bits where, for instance, there's a 6-month siege in which Henry V starves hundreds of people to death at Rouen, which makes him seem a little bit less likable as a hero.
Yeah. We'll probably come back to that again in a second. Going back to that conversation between the princess and the king, it got me thinking, how would one have addressed a monarch in this period, either English or French? Because there's quite a lot of bits of action, bits of dialogue in the film where underlings, you know, lords or princesses are addressing kings in quite forthright fashion. Which seems to me to be unlike, I don't know, I mean, would you have been, if I was an earl, would I have gone up to the king and told him what to do, or would that have been unwise?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, that really struck me as well. I think right until the end of the film, and again, I presume it's because it ties into this story of how he is becoming the king, no one really does anything physically in relation to the king to show their respect. And this is an era when that stuff is hugely important. You bow to the king, you don't look him in the eye. There are records of people just being on their knees in the presence of the king for hours at a time on certain occasions.
That would make for a good film though, wouldn't it? Yeah.
No, I mean, that would be quite boring. Just people kneeling around a king while he reads a letter from an ambassador. But certainly, yeah, the advice you're going to give him is going to be couched, therefore, in the most respectful terms. And even actually at times when there's rebellions happening or, you know, kings challenging other kings to battle or to war, whatever it might be, there's still the language is incredibly respectful and reverent, depending on people's positions. So I think, again, the film sort of in trying to create that brutal medieval world, which is very violent and immediate, I think they just dispensed with a huge amount of what actually made the Middle Ages what they were, because they were a time when respect was phenomenally important. And to a certain extent, I think if you don't have that honour culture represented, chivalry doesn't make sense.
And just going on to your topic of your book, Shadow King, Henry VI, how would that respect and reverence have been affected when he was in his poorly stages, because surely he was, you know, well, tell us what happened to him when he became ill.
So Henry VI becomes king when he's 9 months old, and he rules for about 30 years, not entirely successfully, I think it's fair to say. And then in 1453, he suffers a 16-month-long psychotic break, is what we'd call it today, where he doesn't respond to people, he doesn't talk, he doesn't move, really, as far as we can tell. And after that, he seems to continue, I would say, to have mental health issues, probably profound depression. And we don't know a huge amount about exactly how he was treated in those periods, but we do know that on one occasion, the Lords of Parliament went to visit him and tried to get him to appoint a chancellor, specifically in this case. And that, again, they treated him with profound respect face to face. Although he was sort of this poor, very sickly king, was hauled in front of them, and while he just wanted to have his dinner, was bombarded with questions, that it was still consistently couched in respectful, my lord kings, you know, kneeling in front of him and so on. So I think, yeah, kingship was still completely sacrosanct, even in a case where a king was a baby or just completely mentally absent.
Sure. So, okay, so that's really interesting. So that sense that the king is, you know, to be respected and to be revered, that follows through despite whatever happens to the king.
Yes, and I think it's part of the reason that Henry VI isn't deposed for so long, despite being a manifestly rubbish king, is because of the respect both for him as a person and supremely for the office of king.
Okay, fascinating. Just going back to responses to the film for a second. So one of the interesting, there's been lots of reviews, some of them saying the film's not the greatest bit of filmography ever, but a lot of people have enjoyed it. But the French reaction is quite interesting. There's been suggestions that it basically extends jingoism. It extends this feeling that the English and the French during this period were horrific enemies, which is true, but it doesn't do anything to help current relations between the two countries, and it doesn't truly reflect what happened in the sense of Henry being this just a basic bog standard hero who doesn't do anything wrong, whereas there are, as you've alluded to earlier, some things that perhaps he did do. So, what's your feelings on that? How should we understand the film?
I can see both sides of this argument. I think in order to streamline this narrative, clearly the filmmakers wanted to create a baddie who was just an arch villain, a bit like the sort of the Mel Gibson films of yore where the English were the big baddies, that you would consistently have some toff wandering on and saying something snooty, then murdering someone. That's kind of the role that's being fulfilled here by the Dauphin on behalf of the French. And he is absurd. I mean, it's completely ridiculous, that entire character. To be honest, for me, that actually made the film a slightly more enjoyable because he was actually an interesting character, unlike most of the other people in it. But I do also see that we are at a time when it's very important to be considering how we're expressing our national identity. And I think that Agincourt is sometimes held up as this, like, well, we've been brilliant in the past, we'll be brilliant in the future, which interestingly was a problem in the 15th century. It led to the collapse of the Hundred Years' War by the English because they were so convinced after Agincourt and a later battle, the Battle of Verneuil, that the English would just be able to turn things around in a single battle, that they stopped funding the war, they stopped supporting the garrisons in France, and then they were completely astonished when everything fell apart. So that sense of kind of like national complacency, I think, is still an issue. And a lot of effort has been done. I know it was the director of the Agincourt Museum has been particularly in France.
A brand new museum.
So. Yeah, has been particularly censorious about this film. And I can see why, because a lot of effort has been put into telling the narrative more accurately based on considerable amounts of recent research into this battle and the information surrounding it. So I think we should be having that debate about how we're presenting people who are held up as national heroes. And often they are military and often they are male and they're pretty much always white as well. So, who are the national heroes we should be talking about? How should we be discussing these people? Aren't there other people we could also be considering who maybe are more interesting rather than just retelling those kind of same old stories in very simplistic black and white, in this case, quite literally, very monochrome film terms?
Any names you'd throw into the mix that we should be thinking about more closely?
Oh, well, there are just... One of my great frustrations as a historian of the 15th century is we keep seeing things through Shakespeare. So we keep revisiting Richard III, for instance, Henry V. Whenever we represent Margaret of Anjou, the wife of Henry VI, we present her as this sort of scheming, manipulative figure. And even recently, there was a play put on at the Royal Court, I think, which was about Margaret of Anjou, but it was using Shakespeare. So it was using something that was 100 years out of date rather than going back to the original information about her to examine who she was as a human being and how that worked within the context of society. So Shakespeare, I completely understand it because he's a brilliant writer, although I would argue the Henry VI plays are quite bad. Henry V, brilliant. Henry VI, I think that causes a lot of problems, to be honest. I think we really need to see the 15th century through 15th century eyes.
Okay, so getting rid of Shakespeare, though, that's...
Yeah, get rid of him! Sling him out! I've had enough!
You said that on a... but just thinking about commemoration stuff, we had the anniversary of Agincourt a few years ago. That got quite a lot of publicity. Next year, 2020, will be the anniversary of the Treaty of Troyes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mispronouncing it. Do you think that will get any commemoration? And if so, how should that be remembered? It's a fairly significant event in the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Had there been no Treaty of Troyes in 1420, there would probably not have been such continued issues with the Hundred Years' War and with Henry VI thereafter, because it commits the English to defending the French crown that in the Treaty of Troyes declared as their rightful inheritance. It's hugely important. It's also interesting, I think, in terms of how we talk about peace and the fact that Henry V, who, as we've alluded to repeatedly, is this military commander, also ultimately negotiated for peace. And it's strange that we don't commemorate the pieces quite as much as we commemorate the battles. You know, it took 5 years from Agincourt to get to a peace treaty. Why is it the battle that we remember? Because it wasn't actually quite as decisive as at first it's suggested. You know, otherwise the treaty would have happened in 1415, not 1420. So, yeah, I think that should be considered. Also, next year, anniversary of the Field of the Cloth of Gold,
yep,
1520, which is... again, a peaceful meeting between England and France and an attempt to create international friendships. And at this point in time, again, surely it's quite important for us to be considering international amity, I would argue.
So we should make 2020 the year of peace and treaties.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Again, and also we've had a number of years of considering the impacts of World War One. I think people are already starting to consider the anniversaries with World War Two coming up. Even though it's 20 years away. And I think we should be framing things more around peace and friendship, because the whole point of, surely, commemoration is to re-examine how we consider things. It's not enough to go, oh, well, it's terribly sad that people died. How do we avoid that in the future? And one of the ways is perhaps by focusing more on peace and less on war.
Okay. Last thing then. So just taking things beyond the end of the film... your book is on Henry VI. If they'd extended the film for just a few more years, what might have happened after the treaty?
It would have been brilliant, is what first would have happened. And I think actually Timothée Chalamet should play Henry VI because he's the sort of ideal waifish pacifist for it, I would argue. If the film had continued, it would have been slightly miserable for a little while. Because after the Treaty of Troyes, in which Henry V marries Catherine Valois, Henry continues to fight against the French and actually dies while on campaign in France 2 years later, leaving behind a 9-month-old son, his only child who he has never met, who becomes immediately King Henry VI of England, and also the rightful King of France fairly shortly thereafter. But it takes many, many years of effort to try and get Henry VI crowned King of France. Eventually, when he is crowned, it doesn't end peacefully. And in fact, under Henry VI, the war against the French is lost in really quite catastrophic fashion, leading ultimately to Henry being deposed in England as well. So it's a much more exciting story, I would argue. Much more politicking. And again, some very interesting women.
Okay. And that, of course, is the story told in your book, Shadow King, is the subhead, The Life and Death of Henry Sidgwick. And that's out now. Is it in paperback yet? Or
it will be in paperback in January.
Okay, great. And what are you working on after that? Have you got another book on the go?
Yes. Well, back to my 15th century women. I'm working on Margaret Beaufort.
Ah, okay.
Yes, trying to put her in context with the other women of her time.
Okay. Another fascinating woman. And yeah, so we should have a bit more on the women of the 15th century, and that would make for some slightly more nuanced coverage. Okay, Lauren, thank you so much for that. A very interesting discussion. And thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was Lauren Johnson. The King is available to stream on Netflix now. For plenty more on Henry V and the real history behind the film, head to our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back as normal on Thursday, when Jill Lepore will be discussing the history of the United States.